This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochran, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Tuesday, April 9th. The Prime Minister's top advisors take the hot seat at the inquiry into foreign interference. Just ahead, the new revelations we're learning about the allegations made. And a plea for NATO countries to flex more muscle against Russia and President Vladimir Putin. Coming up, why Estonia says the stakes could not be higher for allies to do whatever they can to help Ukraine. We begin here in Ottawa, where the Prime Minister's top staffers are appearing right now before the inquiry into foreign interference. They're challenging some of the intelligence leaks that prompted this inquiry in the first place. The CBC's Karina Roman is there for us. So, Karina, what are some of the revelations we're learning from the Prime Minister's staff?
Well, let's start with his chief of staff, Katie Telford, who explained to the commission sort of that there are sort of three categories of information from a time period point of view. So pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and post-leaks. And of course, in terms of leaks, they're talking about the news leaks that happened primarily in 2022 and 2023 in terms of what led to this foreign interference inquiry. And the reason she spelled that out is because things changed in her explanation of how information flowed to the Prime Minister's office and eventually to the Prime Minister, especially when we talk about intelligence information, whether from CSIS or another agency. And she talked about something called what they characterize as the challenge function of the PMO, that they're consumers of intelligence, but they also have this function of maybe pushing back sometimes and saying, what we see here, is this actually true? Especially when the stakes are so high. And it's not that they overrule CSIS or they say, no, you have to change this, but they do have a questioning function. And she explained how that worked in one instance. So have a listen to that.
There was a threat linked to an MP that didn't seem right. And so we asked officials to please go and do whatever work they could to further substantiate that and verify that. And to the credit of the officials involved, they went and they worked through the night. And they came to us the next day and reversed their assessment because they had made a mistake. It taught us not to have blind faith in or first blush trust in the information that we would see, because we watched that reversal of the assessment happen and would have had a significant impact on this person's career.
Now, of course, we haven't been told who this MP is, but she was trying to give a sense of so much information coming in and why they can't just accept it at face value and why their role is to question sometimes. Although she did say that if they had come back and said, no, our assessment stands, they would have deferred to the security agency. Another major situation, of course, being discussed at this inquiry is the allegations surrounding the nomination of Han Dong in 2019 as the Liberal nominee to become the candidate in that election. He did eventually win as Liberal MP, although now he sits as an independent. So we have been told, of course, that there was a briefing of the Liberal Party or of people who have been given security clearance in the Liberal Party at that time about these allegations. And because the chair of the national campaign at the time, Jeremy Broadhurst, who is also on this panel today, because he had previous security clearance from a time in foreign affairs, they were able to share that information with him and he was able to brief the Prime Minister on that. And so he discussed their conversation about what action, if any, should be taken and realized that, or came to the discovery for themselves that with the amount of information they have, which was very low, and the bar to overturn a nomination being very high, they decided that there really was no way to take any action and that they just had to hold on to this information. There have been, of course, pushback on that in cross-examination about why they couldn't seek out more information for themselves, but that is how things transpired, according to Jeremy Broadhurst.
Right, and some also interesting testimony that they've rebutted public claims that they were urged by CSIS to revoke Han Dong's nomination, making it clear that David Vigneault, the head of CSIS at the time, made no such recommendation, and that aligns with his testimony and what's shown up in other notes. But Han Dong got a lot of discussion today, in particular a conversation about the allegations that he spoke with a Chinese diplomat at the Chinese consulate and suggested they keep Michael Spavor or Michael Coverage in arbitrary detention even longer. This was something that stood out to me in the testimony today. What did we learn about that specific allegation?
Well, and that allegation was so startling that that's pretty much why Han Dong is no longer a Liberal MP. He doesn't sit in the caucus. He stepped away to, as he said at the time, clear his name. So we heard from Brian Clough, who is the Deputy Chief of Staff, about that time when these news stories broke and what they knew and the meetings they were having about, well, this is the information we actually know to be true. This is what's in the media. Can we correct the record? And he talked, for the first time, at least to my recollection, about figuring out whether they could declassify documents that would show that the allegations in the media reports were not true. Here's how he explained what happened.
We had a number of conversations about how we can get the truth out about this document so that it could be known that Han Dong did not actually advocate for the delay of the release of the two Michaels. So when you see me say options to declassify, it's because we were having a discussion. I don't specifically remember who was in the meeting, but the NSAA was certainly there. We are asking ourselves, and officials are also asking, is there a way to put this information out in the public? At this time, the conclusion was no.
So that was at that time. Of course, things have transpired since then, including the revelation of that CSIS document that is not a verbatim transcript of the conversation that Han Dong had with this Chinese official, but a summary of it, at least according to Mr. Clough. And in it, there is no evidence of him saying that the two Michaels should not be released. Certainly, he's discussing the two Michaels, and there have been questions about why he took it upon himself to have that conversation. But what was said in the media reports is not reflected in the CSIS document. But at that time, they were told they could not come out with that document to refute the claims. Subsequent to this testimony, David, there was also a question from the lawyer for the Conservative Party about whether a recording, an actual recording of this conversation exists, because as we know, the summary is based on a translation because the conversation was in Mandarin. And the answer to that was, we can't tell you that right now. We have to get guidance because, of course, so much of what we're dealing with at this inquiry is based on and around and about classified information.
Right. But it's interesting, though, Karina, that we learn, I believe for the first time, as you said, that the Prime Minister's office sought ways to declassify intelligence to push back against the allegations against one of their MPs. And ultimately, this is one of the challenges we've learned. There is no clear and obvious way to do that in Canada, unlike in the United States. And that's where we are on this. All right. Karina Roman, thank you so much. That's the CBC's Karina Roman in Ottawa. Ottawa is launching a $500 million fund for youth mental health care as part of its April 2024 budget. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland said the fund will support local mental health organizations in providing care to young Canadians in their own communities.
We want younger Canadians to have the support they need so that they are set up for success. Because better funding for mental health services means that younger Canadians can get the help they need right when and where they need it most.
Yara Sachs is the Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, and she joins me now. Minister, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us, David.
$500 million over 4 years to fund a communities-based approach to youth mental health. Why go this route rather than topping up transfers to the provinces?
So this is such an exciting announcement today, and we really, as you mentioned, we have a framework with the bilateral agreements across province and territories, close to $200 billion over the next 10 years, which mental health is a key priority and component to those agreements. But we also recognize that community-based organizations really fill the gaps in many communities when it comes to our youth, and we wanted to really narrow in and invest in our young people now in a way that really meets their needs on the ground.
In the 2021 campaign, there was a similar promise of $500 million over 4 years for university. Is this supplementing that idea, replacing that idea, complementing it? How does it fit together?
So I would say we're broadening it. So as we know, our young people are not only on university campuses and colleges. Our young people are in community, making other choices in terms of their education or building their careers and their futures. But we wanted to really have an upstream approach that met young people where they are right now, to prepare them and set them up for success. So having a community-based approach with local organizations really, for us, is the best way to make those investments.
One of the barriers, it's not just not just for youth, it's for anybody. There's a shortage of practitioners like there is across all spectrums of the healthcare field. So how does this help get people access to sort of mental health supports and treatments that they may need when there are these challenges and bottlenecks that already exist in the system?
And it's a great question, and that's exactly why we embarked on the bilateral agreements. If we look at them overall, 13 provinces and territories, on average, the spending on mental health in those agreements is over 30%. So we know we're already doing a big lift forward when it comes to mental health services across the health systems. But this was an opportunity for us to really zone in on a key area, which was our youth, because this is a generational investment for them. We want to set them up for success going forward. Our young people need the help, especially after the pandemic.
Right, but it's got to be backstopped with the human resource capacity, right? So how does that fit into this plan? I mean, the provinces would presumably have to hire, or these community groups would have to do it, or provide like group therapy or individual therapy and counseling sessions. How do you see that this opening up those opportunities and spaces for people?
Well, it goes hand in hand. In the bilateral agreements, the investments are really looking at making not just the investments in the services that are provided, but the healthcare workforce that we need. So we're building out that workforce with provinces and territories, and then have supplemental service channels through community organizations that will be available.
Okay, so I know you have those bilateral agreements in place. Mark Holland, the Minister of Health, I think signed the last one not that long ago.
All 13, yes.
Things are not that great, though, with the provinces right now, in general, when it comes to federal-provincial relations. As you've been doing this budget rollout as a government, there's a lot of pushback on housing announcements barging into their jurisdiction and other things. Where do you see this fitting into that? Are you worried about sort of the testier relation on climate, housing, and everything with the various premiers getting in the way of this launching and being successful?
I wouldn't say I see it as a concern. I see this as another opportunity to collaborate with provinces and territories. We know we are all serving Canadians at every level of government. Canadians expect us at all levels of government, federal, provincial, and municipal, to invest in them, to make sure that they have the services they need, that they have the housing they need, that they have the infrastructure that they need. As a federal government, we've been listening to Canadians, and we're making those investments, and I have confidence that we will get to where we need to go because Canadians want us to.
I wonder if I ask you about something else. On Friday, Anthony Housefather was on this show, and he, as you know, he's gone through a period of very difficult reflection about his future in the party because of the conflict in the Middle East involving Israel and Hamas, and he decided he would stay, even though he still has some concerns over the policies of this government in relation to that. I know you're a cabinet minister, you're an Israeli-Canadian dual national. This is obviously deeply personal for you, and you're in a different spot than Mr. Housefather because of cabinet solidarity. What was your reaction to his decision, and where are you on this issue right now?
So I'll start with saying that Anthony is such a valuable member of our Liberal caucus. And what's unique about our Liberal caucus is it's really reflective of Canada and Canadians. We have diversity in our caucus. We have individuals with lived experience from a myriad of places and experiences both in Canada and also those who have moved here with their families and made lives here. In Canada, we always say diversity is a fact about Canada, but inclusion is a choice. And the Liberal caucus is really about that inclusion and making sure we have all voices at the table and having the hard discussions that Canadians are having, whether it's here at home or in geopolitics. And Anthony provides a lens. We agree on many, many things. We're both deeply committed to our Jewish communities, both in our own ridings, but across the country. And I would say for the Jewish community right now, the conflict overseas, there's barely a degree of separation for most members of the community with a loved one or a family or a community in Israel. But I would say also that for many other communities in the country, Palestinian community, Muslim communities, they also have loved ones and people that they care about. Mm. As a federal cabinet minister, our role is to hold everyone and to really understand that this is really a traumatic time for many communities. And our policies overseas need to reflect what have been our long, principled positions when it comes to working with allied countries like Israel. We have a 75-year relationship with Israel, and it's one that continues. But friends have hard conversations during hard times. This is one of those times, but our commitment to Israel in terms of its safety and security, its right to defend itself, is unwavering. We're also very clear that hostages must be released. We're very clear that Hamas must lay down its arms. But as Canada, the humanitarian lens is really important to us. It's important to Canadians. We've heard it loud and clear, which is why we continue to push for humanitarian aid. We're seeing more trucks, 400 trucks today went in. We're starting to see IDF troops start to withdraw. And this comes from having those hard conversations that we continue to have government to government, but also to reassure communities here that Canada is part of those conversations abroad, supporting a two-state solution in the long run, but also making sure here at home that tensions come down. Jewish communities shouldn't be targeted the way they've been targeted.
Well, the fault lines of this, the fractures of this go right through your caucus, right through your riding, right?
Sure.
You know, you're feeling this in your community. I saw the protests outside a fundraiser you tried to go through and you were stopped.
Yeah.
You know, do you think you're striking this balance as a government? I mean, House Father obviously struggled very much with it. There are others in your caucus who think you're not going hard enough against Israel, for example. And I know it's the balancing act at the cabinet level. Do you think you're hitting that balance and threading that very difficult needle?
I think that is really the value of the Liberal Party and also of our Liberal government, is that holding the middle is hard. Holding the middle is hard because it's based on deep founded principles that we've held in terms of our place in the world as a middle power, working with other nations to ensure that there is stability in the world, that Western democracies are supporting other Western democracies. But we also know that in times like this, our principled positions are also anchored in international law, humanitarian law, and ensuring that there's stability in regions. And that's what we continue to do. It's not always easy, but that's where the unique place of Canada is in the world, is we have that ability to build those bridges. We have that ability to have those quiet conversations that are principled and careful, but also making sure that we keep nation-to-nation dialogue going throughout this entire conflict. We've continued to speak to the Israelis throughout this conflict. We've spoken to the Palestinian Authority. Minister Jolie has traveled throughout the region to make sure that we're continuing to pull those threads together, because we know at the end of the day, this is a conflict that's gone on for generations. And we know that a safe and secure Israel will be one alongside a Palestinian state, and we will continue to advocate for that.
You said a second ago the Jewish communities in this country, Jewish Canadians, should not be getting targeted the way they're being targeted.
No.
Holding them accountable for the actions of the government of Israel
is absolutely unacceptable.
But Anthony Housefather on Friday said that in his conversations with the Prime Minister that he was going to work with Deborah Lyons, the envoy on combating anti-Semitism, to basically increase efforts in that. Do you think the government has done enough? Because the Jewish community feels pretty targeted. Groups like CEJA and others have criticized this government for not doing enough. Do you think you've been robust enough on pushing back on anti-Semitism in Canada?
I think we have. We are one of the few countries in the world that has a special envoy for anti-Semitism. The United States has one.
But during this conflict specifically?
I think we have done a significant amount. Is there more that we could do? We offered extended SIPS funding through the Security Infrastructure Fund to extend it beyond what was normally cameras or alarm systems, to allow institutions to hire security guards, to have people on staff to ensure the safety and security in the perimeters around community organizations. Normally it was places of worship. We extended that to include community centers, institutions where the community gathers. We've also announced the Community Resiliency Call to Action Fund, which was really to begin to have communities start to talk to each other again, to start to engage with, to really see one another. Canadians should care about their neighbors. The Canada that we were promised, the Canada that, you know, my mother's family, who've been in Canada since the 1880s, understood, is that there was a place for the Jewish community in Canada to build and grow and thrive. And when we've gotten to the point where neighbors aren't seeing their neighbors in a time of trauma and in pain, conflict aside, then that is broken, and that is something that we as a government, through our actions, are starting to rebuild. Is there more we can do? There's absolutely more that we can do, and we'll continue to do it, and that's why Anthony's voice is so valuable.
Just as a final point on this, I mean, we don't know where this conflict is going to go, right? There is international diplomatic efforts to get to a ceasefire, a hostage exchange, while at the same time, Prime Minister Netanyahu says they're getting ready to invade Rafah. So who knows? But the reaction to that continues here, and I just wonder, as someone who as a riding with a big Jewish population, you're in the biggest city where a lot of these protests are happening. As a member of the government, I mean, what are your concerns right now about the societal fracture this leaves behind. We're still dealing with stuff from COVID, right? And now this has penetrated into the big cities in an equally fundamental way. I mean, what are your concerns about where this leaves us?
Well, this is exactly why this announcement today is so important, because our youth are really grappling with these conflicts in the world. They're worried about climate change. They're worried about where their future is going to be from an affordability standpoint, career-wise, being able to afford university, to build a family here. But they're also worried about what's happening in the larger global context. And this is where making sure that we have, I really believe in resiliency of our young people. If they don't have the, if resiliency is really the definition, is being able to bounce back or realign oneself when you're thrown off. Thrown off, whether it's by a conflict on halfway across the world or whether it's in your own community or in your own household. And our young people don't have that same resiliency since COVID. And really having the investments right now in youth mental health and wellness is a key piece to this puzzle going forward, so that we are creating a generation that gets back to what our Canadian values are of caring for one another, standing together, being part of a community that builds one another up so that we're all moving forward together. This is really, investments that we're making now are about fairness for every generation. But with that fairness means that you see what your neighbor needs and you want to support them too. And this is why investments in youth mental health now are so critical and why we're so excited about today's announcement.
Yara Sachs, Minister of Mental Health and Addiction. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank Appreciate you so much.
The Prime Minister's top advisors are on the hot seat today at the public inquiry into foreign election meddling. They're still testifying. Chief of Staff Katie Telford and 2019 Liberal Campaign Director and PMO advisor Jeremy Broadhurst were among those who testified about security briefings on alleged interference by China and leaked information appearing in the media.
It was surprising to us when we were learning this much, much later, that this intelligence existed. Given the state of relations between the two countries at the time.
We were learning things in these leaks. We wanted to try to work with the intelligence agency to recreate the mosaic of information that usually surrounds intelligence, other pieces of intelligence, contacts on the sources, all that kind of stuff, to understand what's the full story, what's the full picture that we can have here. You don't get that with the leak.
The Prime Minister personally is set to testify tomorrow. So what have we learned from this week's testimony? We're going to talk about that with the Power Panel. Emily Nicola is a columnist with Le Devoir. Michelle Cadario is a former Liberal campaign director. Kate Harrison is a conservative political analyst. And Françoise Boivin is a former NDP MP. All right, gang. Look, a big caveat up front on this. We're still dealing with a lot of fragments, incomplete information, and heavily redacted documents. So it's very difficult to have a totally precise picture of things. But Emily, I want to start with something that I thought was really interesting today from Brian Clough, who is the Deputy Chief of Staff in the Prime Minister's office. And he was asked about this reporting that Han Dong counseled China to hold on to the Michaels longer for the political benefit of the Liberals. The political math on that has always been disputed by the Liberals. So have the facts. And he said today they sought methods to declassify the raw intelligence on which this was based to rebut the story, because they felt it was so wrong and so egregious in the claims it made against Mr. Dong. What do we make of this? They were unable to do it, but the fact that the PMO was willing to go to that length to push back on what was being reported.
I think it tells us a really interesting story on what happens when you have that kind of leaks in the media. Because basically, that means that there is somebody usually at CSIS or, you know, somebody who has access to classified information who is leaking that information to a journalist. It becomes public. That information should not have been public, but it's there. And it's there only in fragments. It's there only partially, it is either the fragments that is being shared is at the discretion of the journalist, or oftentimes it's at the discretion of the source. Mm. And God knows what their motivations are to share this thing or not that. And it puts the government in an awkward position, because their information that was made public is classified. Therefore, you cannot complete the picture of what is shared in the media unless you also either do a leak through one of your advisor and pretend it wasn't coming from you, or you seek, as the government was trying to do, to declassify it, because basically one person is fighting with illegal or at least, you know, on not supposed to be out there information, but you as a government are defending yourself with information that is only supposed to be out there. So it's very tricky, ethically speaking, in terms of just trying to find out what a government should be doing when it's put in that situation. And I think it's an answer I don't have the answer to, but it does, you know, raise a really important question. Just what should you do when there's information out there in the public that isn't supposed to be out there? Do you complete it by even basically increasing the leak, or you just say, well, that information should not be out there, and you know, where you're just basically defending yourself, stick to the lines. And then what happens is that you give the impression that you are not giving the public all the information that the public wants, and it creates this impression of secrecy that is really not helping you politically, even though you're doing the ethical thing or at least the legal thing. So it's a tricky situation to be put in.
Kate, what's your sense of what we've learned to this point in this inquiry? So we have these revelations where people in the Prime Minister's office and national security people and the various committees are able to speak more publicly about their internal deliberations to deal with things because of the terms of reference of this committee that they couldn't do in real time. And we're getting fragments of information that show the width and scope of attempts at foreign interference, but also information that suggests some of the initial impressions may not have been quite as presented in the early days of this controversy. I mean, where are we with this after hearing from these people?
Yeah, I think there's two major takeaways at this point. The first one is that at least when it comes to the provision of information to staff and the briefings that occur after that information is presented, there certainly appears charitably to be gaps in terms of what is making it through to the most senior level. In reading a bit about the testimony, I do find it very strange that the Prime Minister, both in his capacity as Prime Minister and as leader of the Liberal Party, may not have had complete and fulsome briefings on the nature of interference to the PMO staffer's testimony. You know, it sounds like that was not provided, at least verbally. And that is very alarming, both, again, in terms of his accountability as Prime Minister and leader of the party. If he wasn't getting that, he should be very concerned by that. And perhaps that's what he will talk about tomorrow. The second thing, though, David, I think is about what's coming out of this is a selection or a selectiveness around when the political staff choose to get involved. So there was that instance you just provided about Han Dong, trying to correct the record there. Mm. There was that story that emerged about interjecting around the Buffalo Chronicle article, seeking to correct misinformation, alleged misinformation in that piece. And the trouble when you're doing that, of course, is that you get questions about, okay, well, why are you interfering on some things, or intervening, excuse me, on some things, but not all? If you had this full information, why wouldn't you have also presented that, not just on the things that you took political issue with because it was a negative for the Liberal Party? So when you start opening the door to the fact that, yes, we did know some instances of interference, but we didn't necessarily disclose that all, and we waited some with more seriousness than others, as we saw, for example, the WeChat conversations that were happening that conservatives were concerned about weren't treated in the same way. That creates a bit of a problem for the Liberals.
Yeah, and so just some context we've gotten on that since the original testimony, because it's happening at a mile a minute, so it's hard to keep track of it all. The Facebook incident happened because Facebook had an agreement with the government of Canada to take down any false or misleading them and a bunch of social media companies. That happened during the campaign. So that was kind of separate and distinct. But the WeChat, they had no agreement with WeChat, and they weren't convinced it was foreign interference, so they took no action. Now, that's the explanation. I'm not saying it is justification, but that's just the explanation we've got at this, because, Michelle, it is difficult to fully understand with the way the documents are coming out now in 2024, what they knew at a point in time in 2019 or what they knew in a point in time in 2021. And this goes back to the other bit of information we got today about the concerns over the nomination in Don Valley North, where Han Dong was the candidate there, a warning from CSIS of potential foreign interference. But the way Jeremy Broadhurst laid it out as a campaign director, and you have experience in this world, he said it was unproven intelligence with no recommendation on what to do. And when they asked for information so they could follow up on it to corroborate it, CSIS didn't provide them with that evidence, gave them no recommendation, told them to use their best judgment, but by the way, you can't share what we've given you as you try to explore, you know, exactly what's going on. I mean, how do you make a decision in that kind of a dynamic in the middle of an election campaign? There's a real challenge there.
Absolutely there is. And I think that it's really important that we, you know, differentiate between what they knew versus they were told, as in no, allegations. They weren't given facts. These were, and they were unsubstantiated allegations at that. And, you know, as you said, there was no action suggested or that. So what are they supposed to do except for to take that on? They're not, you can't, you know, start your own investigation. You're not allowed to share what you've been given. So the best that you can do is monitor the situation and ensure that, you know, you're getting provided any other updates. And if there is a point where action might be suggested, then you can be sure that the security service would come forward to you and they would say that. Like, we've got to trust that system. And I think that, you know, this, if anything, this whole committee is a real kind of bit of a learning opportunity for Canadians to really get a little bit of a glimpse in terms of understanding, you know, what kind of things are actually brought forward and put into notes, which are allegations. And it's very clear, you know, they make a very big distinction between when they absolutely know something that requires action, that is bold, lettered, clear on these kinds of documents, and versus what is an allegation. And they are very careful to always say how, you know, if it's substantiated or not, or just to what level. And so, you know, I think that it's, you know, it's confusing and it's very muddying for everyone. The terminology that's used and how memos and that are even addressed is very confusing. And as a government, you have the responsibility, as they've done, is that if you can't get information redacted so that you can share it with the public, then you just got to take your lumps. Unfortunately, people are going to continue. All you can do is try and educate about what's happening out there in terms of the difference, again, between an allegation and fact. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily suit the opposition's purposes to fortify that distinction. And so it's unfortunate that this kind of thing goes on and on years later.
Francoise, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, to Kate's point about WeChat, I think the threshold for public notification on suspected interference and misinformation is maybe something that needs to be reconsidered coming out of this, regardless of what the decision points were at the time. And the flow of information with the political parties so they can actually do something about these things if they're happening in real time, somehow that needs to be improved because, you know, the scenario I just laid out in Don Valley North, there's no path forward there in the time frame available based on what they were told, it seems. I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, permit me to say one thing, though, first. After watching today and previous day, and I'm thinking, why didn't we have this way before instead of the pounding and pounding inside the House of Commons over and over with huge affirmation, absolutely destructive and so on. And then you're watching the commission and it's, I think it's you use the expression opaque and murky. And that was exactly my feeling at the end of the day today. And I'm thinking, boy, this is no Gomery Commission. This is for the very well informed on the matter. And it told me one thing, too, is that I think you have an expression in English that says hindsight is 20/20 or something to that effect. And it's all fine and dandy. After the commission, we will all pause, hopefully, and become and have grown a bit because we realize how the world changed since 2015 with the sunny ways of election and so on and so forth. Now we're all about foreign interference and how do we act about it? And that naivety that I felt for a long time and that we all have toward outside interference, if it comes to the core of our democracy, we have to act and put our act together. But I'm not even convinced, was it big enough that it warrants all this? Because there's so much information missing that we don't hear. Mm-hmm. Probably not missing, but we don't see it. So I'm really praying that the commissioner will come with some very good recommendation at the end of it that will permit political parties who are, if I was a political party and I was approached by CSIS saying, you might have a problem with a candidate or the way this candidate was elected or won his nomination, or so I would do more than just say, well, do you have proof? I might act a bit more. But that is now, I'm not sure I would have done it in 2019 or even 2021. So I think it might change our behavior, but it is not the commission that is the most exciting to watch, that is the most easy to understand. And we'll see what comes out of it.
But Kate, just a quick point, going back to the WeChat issue, like the threshold for notification, right, is something that I think needs to be sorted out of this. Like, I mean, there's base misinformation. Maybe this was domestic. Maybe it was foreign. I don't know. But there needs to be some sort of clarity over what meets the bar, I think, coming out of this, because this is going to happen next time.
And part of the rationale as to why it didn't trigger that was because, if I'm not mistaken, the conversation was in Mandarin. A lot of the information being shared was in another language. 18% of the population in 2016 identified as Asian. We're bringing more and more people to the country every year. I don't think that because something is published in either English or French, that makes it any less misinformed or potentially disruptive, particularly in particular writings where Mandarin is spoken much more commonly. So I think that is certainly something that needs to change. And really the big part of this entire inquiry is, okay, what's the so what? What are things going to look like moving forward? What resources are actually needed for security, for Elections Canada and others to make sure that we try to minimize disruption? Probably won't fully be eliminated, but there are a few kind of systemic things and operational things that need to be tackled pretty quickly in order to make sure people stay trustful of the process and trustful of the next election.
So Emily, a quick question just to pick up on Francois's point about there's so many gaps in what we can see. This is not an argument against transparency, but this is the challenge with a national security inquiry and national security documents. Justice Aug sees everything. So she will have the complete picture. So presumably her report will be able to get to the so what that Kate has talked about, right? What is the so what here and what are the clear remedies that are needed? The public, though, is going to have to kind of muddle along with incomplete pictures throughout this. So is there a problem with the way this is being done? Is the public going to learn from this kind of a staggered process, or is it possible that just more misinformation and misunderstanding could come out of this because of the incomplete picture that we can see?
Well, first of all, David Johnson is sitting wherever he's sitting being a ha-ha, I told you so.
yeah.
First of all. Second of all, I don't know that the public needs to have a complete the complete picture, in a sense that if the public has a complete picture, so is every foreign government that's trying to intervene in our elections. But there is an issue of trust in terms of when David Johnson was telling us this is what we should be doing right now before there's the next election cycle, there wasn't a trust in him. Now we're doing an inquiry. I'm wondering if Judge Hogg will tell us something more than was already in that report. My worry or my concern is the people are the people who are in charge of implementing solutions better informed, not the public.
Yeah.
Because if they are, and if they are doing their job better, then as a country, our institutions have gotten strengthened. Got stronger because of this inquiry. If the people at CSIS are still unhappy and are still compulsively leaking information to journalists as a way to get their concerns heard, we haven't moved forward. And I think if there's anything as a public we've learned, is precisely this, how we got here. You know, people, unhappy bureaucrats leaking information to the Globe and Mail and Global News and others, that gives us a very partial picture of what's going on. It puts in our heads very important keywords, you know, alleged foreign interference, things that makes everybody worry and mistrust the system and our democracy. And in a way that it makes it very hard to put that toothpaste back in the tube afterwards. I think there's really some things we need to learn as well, not so much on what could be done better, which is the solution, something for the experts, but also in terms of what could be done better in terms of just having this conversation in the media as well.
Okay, Michelle, I've gone over time, but quickly, the Prime Minister testifies tomorrow. Emily just sort of laid out what's at stake for elections and democracy. What's at stake for Justin Trudeau tomorrow, do you think?
He does. I think it's an opportunity for him to clarify what and when he was briefed, to reaffirm what Katie and the others have said today. But I also want to say, you know, it's too bad that Pierre Poilievre didn't take the opportunity to actually get briefed as the Prime Minister offered him, because perhaps if he was, then all, you know, these seeds of unrest and these seeds of concern. Many of them might have been put to rest if there actually is other information there. But he denied doing that, and he instead decided to just be political and partisan.
Okay.
It's a shame.
Okay. We're out of time, but I want to thank you all for joining me. So I always appreciate it. Emily Nicolas, Michelle Cadario, Francoise Beauvais, and Kate Harrison. Thanks so much, gang. See you next week.
See you next week.
Take care.
Russia's war on Ukraine continues to shake transatlantic security. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk says Europe is in a pre-war era, and countries on NATO's eastern flank are preparing. Defense spending is ramping up in a massive way, far exceeding NATO's 2% of GDP commitment. The Baltic nations in particular are preparing defensive lines. Military service in those countries is mandatory. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, Canada is investing in its military at a much slower pace. A cash infusion announced yesterday will see Canada hit 1.76% of GDP by the end of the decade. This as the armed forces faces what the minister calls a death spiral on recruitment. Jonathan Saveljev is the Secretary General of Estonia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Mr. Saveljev, it's good to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This week, Canada has released its defense policy update. It's still going to fall short of its 2% NATO target, get it up to about 1.76% by the end of this decade. Your country's at nearly 3%. How do you feel about some allies not meeting their targets?
Well, we're actually above 3% now. We were at 2% since before Mr. Trump made that a popular target to have. But we've been above 2% because that's a pledge we made back in Wales in 2014. We're also above 3% now because we need to be above 3%. There's war in Europe again. And Mr. Putin is not just attacking Ukraine. He's attacking every core principle of international and European security, the concepts of territorial integrity and sovereignty. He hasn't changed any of his goals. So we all need to do more. And from that perspective, Canada's decisions are obviously positive ones. You're moving in the right direction, and that's the main thing.
Do you think they're moving fast enough, far enough, given the security state right now from NATO's biggest adversary?
You know, some argue that Putin has already failed in Ukraine. His plan A failed, for sure. He intended to kick in the door and have the body politic in Ukraine collapse, after which he wanted to negotiate from a position of strength a new European and transatlantic security order. That failed. But he's on his plan B now, and it's a war of attrition where he thinks the time is on his side. So we don't know whether what we've done is enough, but stakes could not be higher. We better pick up the tempo of the things that we do on our own defense, but also with regard to helping Ukraine into the European Union and into NATO. We shouldn't rest before this is over. If we fail in Ukraine, the cost of maintaining European transatlantic security will just simply skyrocket.
Is the alliance failing in Ukraine right now, though? I mean, you plan A, you're right, it failed. But there's the counteroffensive, and he had entrenched so much because of the slow delivery of aid, and now it's pushing back, and we have this standoff in the U.S. Congress that's holding back the biggest shipments of aid that Ukraine is looking for. Is the NATO alliance getting it done now?
We've certainly taken our time, haven't we? I mean, we're now talking in Europe, we're talking about the 14th sanctions package, not because we've had 14 rounds of good ideas, but because it simply takes time to build a consensus. I mean, that's how democracies function. The question is whether we have time enough, and we need to be very clear about the fact that it's the Ukrainian people who are paying the highest price at this stage, and every day we lose, Ukraine loses not just money, not just infrastructure, they lose people. So we'd better hurry up. We haven't failed, no, far from it. We've surprised Putin, we've surprised the world with the unity we've had, but it's not nearly enough to just rest on the laurels right now and congratulate us, ourselves, for the things that we've done. The war is not over, and until and unless we manage to push Russia to change course and pull itself back into Russia, we haven't succeeded, and we haven't defended the notions of territorial integrity and sovereignty that are so important for not only the stability and security of the transatlantic world, but also for the world writ large. So, no, I don't think we've failed. I don't think we've succeeded. I think the jury is still out there, and we have to do everything we can to make sure that the Ukrainians succeed and push Russia out.
You mentioned the challenge in getting consensus in democracies, and we're seeing that the longer this conflict goes, right? The standoff in the U.S. Congress being the most visible and probably alarming example of that. But you look at this from a situation where NATO had its meeting recently and talked about the need to come up with its own fund to directly fund the defense of Ukraine because of the challenges in the United States. And I've seen some German politicians making the point that Russia, you know, which had an economy the size of Spain when this all started, is somehow outproducing the aid levels that is flowing from all of Western democracies to Ukraine. It seems unfathomable that it could be in this situation.
You're right. And if we take a few steps back and listen to the speeches that we ourselves give about NATO and the strength of the alliance, all of this is true. We're a billion people, the richest people in this planet, with the mightiest military alliance that the history has ever seen. And we're in a struggle for our future with a country that Senator John McCain once famously described as nothing but a gas station with nukes, if I remember it correctly. It shouldn't even be a contest. But unfortunately it is, and the only thing that Putin still has going for him, a powerful argument that he can use at home and abroad, is this notion that in a war of attrition he can outlast us, that time somehow is on his side. That is the central argument we need to attack. So it's not only about the money that we spend on our own defense. It's not only about the assistance we provide to Ukraine. It also has to do with things like Russian frozen assets that we need to find a way to utilize. Accountability, the work that the International Criminal Court is doing. Bringing Ukraine closer to its goal of becoming an EU and NATO member. All of these things that would communicate to the Russians and the rest of the world that no, it's precisely in the long run where democracies enjoy an advantage and the time is on our side.
Where does Estonia stand on the issue of seizing or using the frozen assets of the Russian Central Bank to fund the defense and rebuilding of Ukraine? There is a division on this. I know France has said worried about legal precedent and what it might mean. Where's your country on that?
There's a discussion that's ongoing. Our position is fairly simple. We got to go in and we got to take it. For the practical reason of needing the money, but first and foremost, in order to send a clear message that we have indeed reached the point of no return, that this desire, this hope that one day a Chamberlain might appear and deliver peace for our days again by making a deal and sacrificing the freedom of others in order to buy themselves stability, that this hope is futile. Until and unless we convince the Russian leadership of that, I don't think we're going to be able to push them to change course. Utilizing frozen assets is an important policy that we need to pursue in order to send that message.
So we're seize them and spend the $300 billion or just use the revenue from it?
The revenue is a no-brainer.
Right.
But from our perspective, yes, we need to go ahead with the use of the funds themselves. I mean, look, you know, we've all said that Russia is responsible for this crime of aggression. We've all said that at the end of the day, Russia needs to be held responsible, held accountable for the damages it has caused. We know today that just the infrastructure damage alone is more than 700 billion euros, more than, the, I think, $800 billion then. And we have 300 billion of Russian money here. There's a perfectly logical way we can do it legally. We can utilize the funds in order to, as a down payment, if you will, for the cost that Russia has to pay anyhow. It's also important strategically because it would indeed send a message that the hope of a Chamberlainian outcome is futile. And that's why we need to push ahead.
You want a Churchillian outcome rather than a Chamberlain.
I think, you know, we all saw what happens when you try to buy yourself stability with the freedom of others. Ends in catastrophe and not just for those who are being sacrificed. I think we should learn from the mistakes we made in the past. I think we have, but the jury is still out when it comes to this war, so we need to push ahead and using Russian frozen assets is an important policy area that we need to make progress on.
Ukraine is the major front in this right now. One of the future fronts and front of the moment really is the Arctic. And I know you've been speaking with Canadian government officials, and in this defense policy update we referenced off the top, there is a shift to focusing on Arctic security and sovereignty in Canada's military posture. You're a northern nation as well, with a focus on that. What is the biggest concern your country has with Russia, the Arctic, and especially with things opening up because of climate change?
You know, in NATO, we've had this saying that the alliance ought to focus on a 360-degree approach to security. We've always subscribed to that idea. And today we're seeing Russia pose a 360-degree challenge. You talk about the high north, we agree. The Russians are investing heavily in military capabilities in the high north. But, you know, we in Europe, we also focus on Africa, for instance.
Right.
We're seeing Russian malign activities pop up all around the continent. We obviously discussed Ukraine. We can talk about the cyber domain. We can talk about the informational domain. What Russia is trying to do is push us out of the security framework that we've created over the past several decades. They're a 360-degree challenge. So we have to confront them everywhere, defensively, and we have to find a way to push them to change course.
Just as a final point, how do we do that at this stage? This many years into this conflict, they're gaining. They've had Crimea now for close to for a decade. The consequences of past actions have not been severe. So how do you drive it home now?
Depends on how you want to look at it. 30 years ago, I would not have been able to sit here because we were occupied. We were occupied and half of Europe was under Moscow's control. And yet, the free world was able to push Russia to change course. These big wars, they aren't just contests of arms, they are contests of wills. I'm confident that democracies at the end of the day prove to be stronger, especially in the long run. So we have to do all of the things that we've been doing up until now. Sanctions, international isolation, helping Ukraine materially, but also with the resource of hope, bringing them closer to NATO and EU membership, which is something that they aspire for. Accountability through international institutions, the International Criminal Court, and finding a way to address the crime of aggression that is being committed, utilizing Russian frozen assets, all of the above to send a strategic message to Moscow that the course they are on right now, at the end of the day, will cost them more than they're willing to put up. So once we manage to convince them of this, once we manage to convince them that we will not be changing course, that we will not be collapsing in terms of our political unity, I think we'll be able to do it again and then build a more stable transatlantic security to face the challenges we all know we're going to face in the 21st century. But we have to see through this challenge before we can address the others. If not, I mean, the list of challenges remains the same, from global issues, terrorism, climate change, new geopolitical players stepping up their game. The question is whether we confront those challenges from a position of strength, having defended transatlantic security in Ukraine, or from a much weaker position, not as a united transatlantic democratic world, but a group of, frankly, mid-sized powers quarreling with each other over what certainly will seem like an avoidable defeat. So my suggestion would be to win this and then go forward together.
Jonathan Saviov, it was good to meet you. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.